Rosa.
Hi, Eli.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay. This is actually a triumph of humans over technology day for me.
Me too.
I succeeded in getting my webcam for Blogging Hands off the wide angle setting, which is actually an enormous relief to me.
Yes. Well, I did not succeed in getting a headset, so when you see this, I'm talking to you on the phone.
Oh, that's okay. That's fine. I thought of doing that, except that then my neck gets tired and my hand gets tired and stuff like that. So, actually, I'm sort of wondering. I'm actually one of the last remaining human beings who has not yet gotten a hands-free headset for my cell phone, just because it's too embarrassing to walk around looking like you're talking to yourself.
I know, it's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
It looks like the city is filled with crazy people.
Yeah, but I think I have to get over that.
Maybe. Yeah, I don't have one either.
I think I should just get used to looking crazy, actually.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, so what are we going to talk about?
Well, I thought we could start off with, this is maybe seeming a little bit out of topic, but last week, a nominee for ambassador was withdrawn because he was involved with the Swift boat issue. And as a
do you think that's why he was withdrawn? I mean,
No, I think there was. I think the White House understood that there was no way anybody affiliated with the Swift boats, the Swift boaters for truth, were ever going to get anything in a Democratic controlled Congress. So, it just brought up an interesting issue to me because I know that you'd recently written about this. For the LA Times column with CPAC, and I have a lot of friends who voted for Kerry and supported him, and if you mention the Swift boat issue, they get almost apoplectic, and it's a little, and I just was asking, because from my perspective, it didn't seem nearly as awful as, you know, Josh Marshall on his blog at the time made it seem, but then now, 2 years after the fact, Why is this issue still have such resonance for a lot of liberals?
I think it actually has about as much to do with frustration on the part of Democrats with Kerry as anger at the Swift voters. I mean, I think it's made up in equal parts of both. The anger at the Swift voters is just a straightforward sense that, wait a minute, this was an election in which one guy had managed to not go to Vietnam at all, the other guy had gone and gotten some medals. You know, is this... It seems pretty hypocritical to start pointing fingers at the guy who actually went and got the medals. That's the anger at the Swift voters. And, of course, needless to say, anger that a lot of the charges obviously turned out to be unfounded. A lot of them were pretty irresponsible. Anger at the media for picking it up and taking it much more seriously than it should have been taken. So that's the part that's anger at the Swift voters. But I actually think that people's hysterical reaction about it is at least an equal part total frustration with John Kerry and the Kerry campaign. I mean, not just for, I mean, here's the standard line on this is, oh, they should have taken it more seriously and fought back earlier.
Right.
In some way, that to me has always seemed to be missing the point. I mean, to me, the thing that was deeply frustrating about John Kerry's campaign was that he wanted to disown a big part of his Vietnam and post-Vietnam self because it seemed like a political liability to him.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was really stupid because, first of all, it was there. People were going to talk about it. Second of all, it shouldn't have had to be a liability. You know, he should have been able to say, you know, look, I was young. I felt passionately about these things. I said some stupid things that hurt people that I bitterly regret. That said, you know, I believe that I was doing the right thing. I still believe that there were real atrocities that were committed. We know that that's the fact. You know, it's an uncomfortable reality. I'm sure I exaggerated, but it's also true that there were real issues. Everybody, you know, that's hard to dispute at this point in time. You know, and I really believe that I was doing something for our country. I believe that the war was wrong, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that I think, and if he had then been able to say, but you know what, the bottom line here is that there were a lot of patriotic people who had very different views on the war. I did my best. Would I do exactly the same thing now? Probably not. But am I ashamed of what I did? No, I'm not. You know, it just would have eliminated the issue. And said, okay, now let's move on and talk about things today. You know, let's move on and talk about other things. And I think the fact that he could never do that, that he just didn't want to talk about it, that all he wanted to do was go up at the, you know, convention and go,
Commander
a cringe-inducing. Yeah, it was
right.
just embarrassing. It was horrible.
Right.
It was really depressing. You know, and it had a real impact on how he talked about the 04 campaign issues, too. I mean, he really was amazingly slow to come out and say, that the Abu Ghraib abuses were appalling, for instance, that he was concerned about Guantanamo, that we should never torture people, that this had to do with American values. The reason he didn't want to say any of that stuff is because he, you know, he was so paranoid that it was going to get linked back to his post-Vietnam protests and statements in a way that would hurt him. So he stayed silent on things that were, I think, real issues both that matter to the Democratic base, but also issues that matter to a lot of independents, you know, those crucial small number of voters who were trying to make up their mind, and they wanted to see him look like he stood for something consistent.
I always thought that the Kerry campaign was asking for something like this because they presented him as someone who was running as this, you know, Vietnam veteran, when in fact he appeared before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and Chairman Fulbright and compared his fellow soldiers to war criminals, and I think he invoked Genghis Khan.
Well, wait a minute. That's being a little bit unfair to him too, because if you look at his testimony in context and you look at the full text of his remarks, and he is very clear that he's not talking about it. There's an us and a them, and there are those bad soldiers, and then there's good old me. You know, he's saying this is something that happens to decent people. This is a war.
Well, but there are a lot of Vietnam veterans, right, who would disagree. I mean,
sure,
and,
but there are also a lot who would agree and who did agree.
Yeah, I mean, and you're absolutely, and it was a divisive issue. But the fact of the matter is, I would venture to guess, and I haven't polled them, that most people saw what Kerry did as an act of betrayal at the time, who were part of the Vietnam veterans.
I don't think you're right. I don't know either. I mean, I can't say, oh, Eli, you're dead wrong, and I've got the polling data to prove it. But I don't think that's true. I really doubt it. It'd be interesting to find out. Some blogging head person should go and actually.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And there, you know, in any war, there are going to be veterans who are going to disagree, and I think it's wrong to sort of say. Right. To speak for all the veterans in such a way. But it certainly hit a nerve. And I have one of my theories about the politics of war and peace, not really my theory, is that oftentimes people are not so much voting for, but they're voting against. And it's a powerful symbol. And that Kerry had identified himself during the Vietnam War with the, you know, hippies and the anti-war protesters that really probably elected, you know, Nixon in 68 and 72, or at least those were his constituency were as much voting against those people as they were, voting for Nixon. I just think that that they were kind of asking for it. And the other thing I was going to say is that in American politics, it's kind of par for the course. People attack other people's war records all the time.
Yeah.
And, I mean, granted, it was during a campaign and that the money, I think the stronger ground was that the money for this 527 came from people who were in the Bush, inner circle. But at the same time, memories, are going to differ. Yeah. And Kerry was really slow to release some of his records.
But I think, I mean, as I said, I think that the liberal anger at the Swift voters has 50% to do with distress at Kerry himself and the way that he handled not only the Swift vote ads, but also the way he handled the whole issue of Vietnam and his war record and his post-war protests, that he wouldn't own any of it. And actually, let me come back to that in a second, because I think there's a, you know, it's related to the whole liberals fleeing from the term liberals because people think it's bad, rather than being willing to say, okay, let me think about what I mean by liberal, and if that's what you call liberal, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I'll claim that. You know, I think that Democrats and liberals have just been on the defensive for so long that that's kind of informed their strategies in a way that's really self-destructive. But the thing I was going to say about Swift voters, I'll tell you an anecdote. I worked in a very, very lowly capacity, in volunteer capacity, in connection with the Kerry campaign during the 04 campaign. I was one of the directors for the Policy Task Force on Human Rights and Democracy and Development, and we turned out all these, you know, talking points which nobody ever used, background memos that nobody ever used, and we felt kind of important because we were turning out the stuff that nobody paid any attention to. But on the rare occasions that anybody actually paid any attention to anything we did, or even pretended that they might possibly be going to use something we did, we would submit these very detailed memos with footnotes and everything, because it was actually a lot of law professor types, and to the Kerry campaign. And we would make statements about one thing or another, and they would come back to us and say things like, well, can you get the chapter and verse on that? Because we cannot say this stuff unless we are absolutely sure that it is right, you know? And I sure didn't get the impression that anybody in the Bush campaign, or God forbid anybody in the Swift voters, were saying to each other, you know, we better not say this unless it's ironclad that we can defend it. You know, and I think that's one of the other things that just makes progressives and liberals so angry about the whole thing, is the sense that you know, Kerry may have been too slow and too dumb and too craven to talk about his prior activities post-Vietnam, but at least, you know, that campaign didn't just make stuff up or just throw out totally irresponsible charges without, you know, really without caring at all about
the press. I don't know, there were some pretty irresponsible charges that Democrats have leveled against this administration. You know, a lot of this story of the lie about the war, in my opinion, is just, I mean, we're back from a slight technical glitch.
We're back from a technical glitch caused by my technical incompetence.
Okay.
We have no idea what we're talking about.
Just to wrap up.
Okay.
Democrats said during the 2004 campaign, and then continued to say, things like 22 neocons and Ahmad Chalabi tricked the CIA into believing Iraq had WMD. And, or like, you know, some of the charges that were...
They didn't?
What?
They didn't?
No. Well, obviously. No, okay, anyway. And, that's funny. You know, some of the charges leveled against John Bolton during his nomination hearing, like from this woman, Melanie Townsend, who said, you know, he chased her around Kyrgyzstan with a stapler. And there were all kinds, to me, it's politics to a certain extent, which is that political speech from politicians, especially in a campaign, I mean, I believe you that a lot of these statements were sort of double-checked, but I bet some of that hesitation, Rosa, was due to the fact that at the time, probably the Kerry campaign assumed in 2004, Americans liked the idea that we were detaining and not affording, you know, full rights to terrorists.
And I think that was a form of political cowardice, because I think that even at the time, you know, actually the polls were actually interesting at the time. They were all over the place in a way that made perfect sense, because it just depended on how you frame the question.
Yeah.
And to me, when you get a bunch of polls that the answers of which are all over the place depending on how you frame the question, the moral of that story is that whether you win or lose on the issue depends on how you frame the issue yourself. You know, that doesn't mean stay away from it. It's a loser. It means, you know, think about how you want to frame this.
And, it's a lake-off.
Lake-off, whatever. But I don't think you need lake-off to get this basic insight. You know, that if Kerry had been able to come forward and say strongly, you know, folks, you know, we are not going to sacrifice our security, but we are also, you know, we're not going to sacrifice our security by letting dangerous terrorists out, but we're also not going to sacrifice our security by betraying our basic values in a way that makes enemies throughout the world when we don't have to. You know, and let me tell you what we can do. Let me tell you why this connects to our basic constitutional traditions. Let me tell you why we can keep ourselves secure and have a fair process at the same time. You know, I think it was cowardice. You're right. I mean, it was an issue that actually Kerry could have turned to his advantage, I think. But I think there was such fear of anything that might ever be spun by anybody as soft on national security that they actually missed a real opportunity to hurt them.
Yeah, I'm not Karl Rove, but I mean, coddling terrorists, you know. I mean, I'm just saying that it's a fairly easy, and especially in 2004, more so than now, was a sense that people had bought on to sort of the war on the abstraction of terrorism, and, you know, it was going to be different. They had accepted to a certain extent that we were fighting in the shadows, and I might add that after 9/11, people like Seymour Hersh were writing, well, you know, I was wrong maybe all these years against, you know, extrajudicial assassinations and so forth. And this is a good segue into our next topic, which is Gitmo, Guantanamo.
Right.
So, you know a lot about this, and you were going to sort of ask me a few questions.
This is the thing that I was going to ask you. I raised this with Mark Schmidt. He didn't know the answer.
Okay.
So maybe you know the answer.
Yes.
One thing that has just always mystified me about some of the Gitmo stuff and so forth has been why? You know, that we know that the vast majority of these guys, you know, are just like Afghan Joe Schmoes, 21-year-olds who either were foot soldiers for the Taliban,
right,
or weren't even that, were informed on by their second cousin who had a grudge against them or whatever it may be.
A lot of them. Yeah.
A lot of them, yeah. And, you know, we also know that even some of the guys who are a little bit worse than that, you know, that the amount, it does become a question of, you know, the economist called the externalities, right? You know, what are you gaining from holding them indefinitely with virtually no legal process versus what are you losing from holding them indefinitely with no
right.
legal process in terms of, you know, pissing off other people in the rest of the
sure.
world, reducing your credibility. And I just don't get it. It seems certainly at this point, I can understand, I have not that much sympathy, but I have some sympathy for the sort of post 9/11 panic, right? The sort of, oh my God, you know, this could happen again. We have no idea what's going on. Just take off the gloves. But 2 years later, 3 years later, 4 years later, 5 years later, 5.5 years later, what on earth is going on? Why don't
well,
we just...
Well, I mean, first of all, I think I agree with you in that it would have been made a lot more sense given the fact that our intelligence in a lot of cases in getting these people on the battlefield mm-hmm. was so awful that if we would have had the base in Bagram, you know, or a theater where we were fighting, then it would be fairly easy to open the back door of the jail and let the innocent people go once we determined they were innocent,
yeah.
instead of shipping them to Cuba. You know, so that's the first thing. So I think I would agree with you. As a conservative, I guess I would say I'm mystified that the administration didn't take the opportunity after 9/11 to have a discussion about how we were going to deal in this new war with ununiformed combatants
mm-hmm.
and have a discussion with the public. Have it out. It's not a – I mean, I don't necessarily have a doctrinaire view of it, but it's unforgivable in my estimation that this was done with, like, you know, legal memos written, you know, by, you know, the Pentagon's lawyers, the Justice Department, and the Vice President. I mean, no, this should have been a conversation. We're an adult society. It's our government. And they shouldn't have treated us like children and just said, trust us, when they were making significant changes to these to the procedure and rules in these cases. Though, I would just say a caveat here. We also know that the kinds of techniques that have been criticized by so many civil libertarians, you know, been practiced by the CIA and our, and more importantly, allied intelligence services.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, I think that the liberal side has to ask themselves, how much rendition am I willing to tolerate, given the fact that I bet innocent people are going to get an even worse rap if they get, you know, sent to an Egyptian jail or a Saudi jail or a Syrian jail. Anyway, but as to the administration's why not close it now, I think that there are two issues. One is a lot of the countries don't want these guys back.
Right.
So that's the first thing, and I think
so
that
try
that...
them.
What?
So try them. If they've committed a crime, try them.
Right, and then it leads to the second problem, which is that in some cases you don't want to try people if you feel that you would have to, you know, present evidence that would reveal sources and methods. Now, I, as a journalist who covers national security, I hate that because they use it all the time, and I think that they often, you know, invoke this idea just as a way to sort of keep secrets for no good reason. However, I would say that even the Clinton administration in the 96 Counterterrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act introduced the idea of having secret evidence in immigration hearings.
Yeah.
Because there is probably a need when you're especially dealing with human sources overseas that you need to protect identities of people, and even letting people know what information that you have could be perilous for your assets.
That I don't think anybody disagrees with
yeah.
that, though. And I also think that you know, contrary to a lot of the mythologizing coming primarily from the Vice President's office on this stuff, you know, that American federal courts already have a lot of tools to have ex parte and in camera proceedings to keep some evidence from press to
sure.
close. You know, that you know, I don't think this should be framed as well. We have a choice between, you know, everything comes out, including the names and addresses of our you know, top secret covert agents in the field, versus oh well, I guess we just have to lock them up forever, even though they may either be innocent or maybe totally minor league players. You know that there's plenty in between. We already have a lot of mechanisms, if necessary, for protecting secret national security evidence while at the same time satisfying basic fairness standards in federal courts. To the extent that the Bush administration thought you know, this was a Congress to, at that point, certainly, to which they could easily have gone and said, you know, yeah, we've got these protections, but we're worried about these other situations. Could we get some legislation that makes some tweaks that would fully protect national security evidence? So it's just weird. It just seems so weirdly bullheaded. You know, it also seems to me, and here's a parallel potentially with the immigration stuff, and I think one of these days the Supreme Court is going to obviously have something to say about this. You know, or it's like civil commitments. You know that there are categories of people, not just suspected terrorists, where it's hard to get the information and where there may be security issues in terms of what the evidence is. But there are other categories of people, like people who've been civilly committed and immigration detainees, where their countries won't take them back or something.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes a sort of basic due process dangerousness inquiry. You know, and if there should be some fair process for trying to figure out, you know, is this person going to be doing any harm to anybody, and what are the infringements on that person's basic human rights of keeping them? What are the, frankly, the PR hit that we're going to take for keeping them, versus what is the likelihood that they're really going to do anything very dangerous if they're let go, even in the United States? You know, I mean, it just seems like, I mean, I think the bottom line to me, I actually have never been very, in some ways, I've never been very interested in the whole business of, well, you know, are they combatants or are they not combatants, or, you know, what the hell are they? And
right.
Are they, you know, did the black turbans for the Taliban count as uniforms and
mm-hmm.
whatever? You know, the Al-Qaeda guys wear a little tiny lapel pin saying, hi, I'm Al-Qaeda. You know, to me, you know, as a human rights person, the bottom line on all of this stuff is, you know, have a process that reflects sort of basic values of Western civilization, if you want, you know, of universal norms.
Yeah, well, why couldn't, well, the trials in some ways could be a demonstration, you know, in our favor in the information.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter. You can call them whatever you want. You know, you can call them, you know, purple people eaters. You can call them combatants. You can call them criminals.
Right.
But come up with a process that's, you know, some kind of process that satisfies basic standards of fairness.
You know,
and we all
I
know
think,
what they are. And they couldn't do it. Like, they couldn't do it. Why?
Well, reasonable people, or at least I would say I'm with you for most of it. The only difference is that I think that there are plenty of cases where a terrorist that would be captured mm-hmm. would have tactical information that I'm really not that concerned. I mean, what I'm concerned about is if you have standard operating procedure where anybody on the battlefield can just, you know, torture
mm-hmm.
people, then you're going to have insane abuses, and that's
right.
That's, I mean, I'm just, I don't know any American who could support that. So for me, the sin of the administration was the haphazard way, the kind of like de facto way they created the interrogation regime and how we handle the detainees without a proper conversation, without proper consent of Congress. Because at the end of the day, they should have realized that this was bound to happen anyway. The journalists would find out a lot of what's going on.
Yeah.
And that unless people had bought in some level politically early on, then there would be this outrage. So, you know, I mean, it's amazing to me that anybody could ever say that, like, you know, Rove and company are such brilliant Machiavellian strategists when they make so many political...
Well, you know the thing which always makes me sort of sad and embarrassed and it's ironic is when you think about states that use torture, pre-9/11, states that use torture or, you know, quote, torture-like procedures, by and large, they're weak states. You know, and in particular, they're often states that aren't using torture for, quote, political reasons. They're states where cops and detectives and security people are using torture just as a shortcut. You know, that if you're a cop in a very poor country and you don't have you don't have a fancy DNA lab, you don't have a big budget to send investigators around, but you've got political pressure on you to solve a crime. Well, frankly, you know, you got a suspect, you torture the guy, he confesses, end of story. You can, you know, you check that box off. You know, the torture is sort of a weapon of the weak. Torture is what you do when you have no resources and you have no clue. You know, you really have no other way.
I don't know.
To figure
a
out
lot.
What's going
a,
on.
I think the worst torturers, you know, states like Iran, for example, use torture as a means of intimidation.
Oh no, I don't mean to dispute the fact that torture has historically and continues to be used in many states in the world as an instrument of political repression and control, you know, to instill fear for that purpose only. But just when you look at the kind of the widespread use of torture, you know, a lot of it isn't about repression. A lot of it is desperation. A lot of it is weakness. A lot of it is we don't know what's going on. We can't control this stuff, you know, and this is it's a quick and easy shortcut, and frankly may not get the truth, but that doesn't matter because it makes us look like we're doing something. And it's so sad to me to see the U.S. becoming that kind of state, because that is what it boiled down to, that after 9/11 we went, oh my God, you know, this is terrible. People hate us. Why? We don't know what's going on. We don't have people who speak the language. We don't know the cultures. Yeah. We don't have a clue. We don't have the first notion, really, how to go about getting the intelligence that we need to figure out, you know, if another 9/11 is going to happen tomorrow or maybe never or what. You know, and turning to torture just shows that desperation. And like most things done out of desperation, I think it's backfired terribly.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could just – there are a lot of situations, particularly – with Iraq, and maybe this is a good segue, but there, you know, there is an industry of truck bombers in Iraq, mm-hmm. and there's a guy who knows the locations of when he's going to deploy these human artillery, and
how do you know that you've got the guy who knows the
well? Locations? It's obviously, you know, it doesn't work really having an abstract conversation about
right.
it, but
right.
there are times when, you know, you're there in the hideout or whatever, I would assume, and that. In that situation, I honestly could see not any torture, but certainly rougher interrogation that would probably be frowned upon by, you know, a European Union commissioner or something, that in order to get real-time information to find out where those suicide bombers are. And so that kind of ticking time bomb scenario
yeah,
is not as far-fetched, I think. It's
okay, but you're making a couple of assumptions in there,
yeah.
and there's, of course, the slippery slope argument. I mean, the assumptions that you're making in there that are at the root of all the variants of ticking time bomb hypotheses, you know, you're assuming that we are ever going to have any reasonable level of certainty that this guy that we've got really does know something, really is guilty, and you're assuming that the whatever, I mean, you're shying, you're saying, oh, not torture, but just sort of rougher interrogation methods, are in fact more likely than other methods to produce the truth as opposed to produce misleading information. I mean,
did you see Mark Bowden's piece in The Atlantic that came out about torture and interrogation?
This is the one a couple years ago.
Yeah, it was actually the first one that really looked at it.
Yeah.
And that was the first, and at least I read that and I said to myself, it's a tough issue, and some of this stuff I can understand. And he seemed to sort of present both sides. So I don't,
well, you know, look at some of the more recent stuff. I mean, there's actually a really interesting report, which I did not mm-hmm. read all of because it was about 400 pages
yeah.
and it crashed my computer when I tried to download it. But the Intelligence Science Advisory Board, for instance, recently did, you know, this huge report on, okay, what do we in fact know about what interrogation techniques are effective?
Oh,
and,
I should read that,
you know,
yeah.
No evidence whatsoever that coercive interrogation techniques, harsh, alternative, whatever euphemism we want to use here, are in fact more effective than good old-fashioned, you know, offer the guy a cigarette, you know, ask him how his mom is doing, et cetera. You know, there's just no evidence that it's effective.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a good deal of reason to believe that it's ineffective and that it backfires more often than not. And, you know, the slippery slope issues, you have to think about the externalities. You have to think about, well, if you have a reputation for treating prisoners harshly, that's going to affect the likelihood that people are going to fight to the death as opposed to surrendering. That's going to affect the likelihood that the average guy
mm-hmm.
on the street cooperates with you. That's going to affect your overall
mm-hmm.
reputation and willingness of others to be allied with you.
Yeah.
You know, and this is something that you said a couple minutes ago that I think is also important. You know, if you've got your average, ordinary soldier with the idea in his head that it's okay to make up his own mind, when it's okay to move from the Geneva Convention norms to rough stuff of some sort, you're going to have a whole lot of it, and a lot of it's going to be on innocent people.
Okay, just if we could slow down a second, okay? I imagine that we probably would agree with what would be okay interrogation and not okay interrogation. But what I don't trust, just because I don't like the institution of the United Nations,
mm-hmm.
is it seems I just don't want ever more restrained interpretations from international bureaucrats saying, nope, this counts as torture now.
Wait, but what does the UN have to do with this?
Well, there are interpretations of the, you know, interpretations of
right.
what Geneva would necessarily mean
but
enter into this.
But why do they enter into this? Who's they and why do they, I mean, this is federal criminal law. This is Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Yeah.
You know, as well as the Geneva Conventions as interpreted.
But when people say that you have to have the Uniform Code of Military Justice cohere with Geneva, I'm not defending the. I'm just saying that you can interpret Geneva in a lot of different ways.
But,
you can have different justices in different countries sort of say no, that's what this treaty means. And I understand that this is a very, you're in a much firmer ground. You have a law degree and I don't. Yeah. But then
let me reassure you though that, yeah. that's a red herring. I mean the who would judge an American soldier, for instance, if he were accused of mistreating a detainee? Well,
I don't know. If you guys get your way, it's probably like Hague or something.
But that's, again, I mean, that's just a misunderstanding of the state of the law and this stuff. I mean, the International Criminal Court, among other things, relies on the principle of complementarity, which basically means that national courts get first dibs on trying somebody, and we do have a legal process. You know, I don't think it's always a perfect legal process, but I don't think that there's really any significant dispute that it's a reasonably fair legal process. You know, it would be the U.S. military justice process, or in some situations involving contractors, et cetera, the U.N. civilian justice process. The U.S. civilian justice process that would be making these decisions. There's just no issue about, are U.S. personnel going to be held to account in some foreign court for some weird and unpredictable and wacky foreign interpretation of a treaty? Doesn't happen.
Well, it hasn't happened yet, but we're in very new territory with the International Criminal Court, right? Had we had a Gore administration, we would not have had the policy to ask countries not to observe, you know, not to promise to never send one of our soldiers to an International Criminal Court. But
that started under Clinton.
Clinton didn't do those bilateral agreements.
Yeah, he did.
He did?
Yeah, sure. I was on the U.S. negotiating team for the ICC for a little while in a very lowly capacity, and we were negotiating Article 98 agreements like crazy.
Really?
Not me personally, but...
I remember the Article 98 agreements were like every, a bunch of human rights groups were like, this is so terrible.
Right.
Why is the Bush administration... See? But when Clinton does it, it's fine.
No, they were mad. Believe me, they were totally pissed off when Clinton was doing it, too.
Okay, well, listen...
Yeah. You know, I actually think that they were completely unnecessary given the statute, given the layers of protection that existed. But this is a different, maybe we should have a whole blogging heads dialogue about
the ICC. Yeah, and I'm probably the wrong guy, because I don't have a law degree.
Because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. And one of the very funny things that used to happen when I was on that ICC delegation,
yeah.
It had people from all these different agencies, and it was a huge delegation, mainly because every agency had to send like a zillion people to spy on all people from the other agencies, keep them from screwing up in some way. And so my experience was all these military guys would be sent from the Pentagon to be on the delegation, and they would come with these instructions, you know, kill the ICC, kill it dead. And they would, you know,
mm-hmm.
they would wade into it a little bit, and they would start saying things like, well, yeah, this actually doesn't seem that bad. You know, actually, I think we ought to be able to live with this. You know, this really has a lot of protections. And they write some sort of long, convoluted memo back upstairs, you know, send it back upstairs. They'd probably be yanked back to Washington and replaced with some other guy. And part of the problem, quite honestly, is you know, speaking as a lawyer, is that law is boring, law is technical, law is complicated. You know, the Rome Statute, hundreds of pages. It's really hard to completely understand it unless you spend a huge amount of time thinking about it and reading it and trying to figure out how its parts interrelate. And in order to convey the reasons that this was not a huge threat to the U.S., anybody who wanted to write a memo had to write a really long memo. And we all know that the American policymaking apparatus is carefully designed prevent any policymaker from ever reading anything longer than about one page,
sure.
which meant sort of almost by definition,
right.
something where the reassurance required you to appreciate complexity was just never going to get up there. Was never going to get there. So,
okay. Well, this actually sort of gets us to Iraq, and I would point out that there are European courts that are sort of toying with the idea of trying certain Americans for war crimes. So this is not a completely dead issue.
This is the Donald, don't take your vacation in Germany edition.
Yeah, yeah, seriously. Anyway, that wasn't on the list. Who are you, Germany? Anyway.
They know something about war crimes.
Yeah, they know something about war crimes. They're so pristine. Anyway. Okay, so let's talk about... Okay. This is... We before we did this Blogging Heads, we thought for you, Blogging Head TV viewer, that it would be boring to just see two people argue about Iraq again. So I thought... And I'll start this off. What would it take to change... Well, actually, before we do this, Rosa, tell me your position on the current timetable for withdrawal and now the, you know, kind of ever more... insane, or I don't want to say that. I don't want to prejudge. But these tactics over this budget fight with Harry Reid, and it seems like the Democratic position is going ever more closer to what the party did to stop the Vietnam War. So where are you on withdrawal?
And what the Republican Party did to get troops out of Somalia and to try to restrict Clinton's ability to use U.S. troops in Bosnia, Kosovo, et cetera.
There were a lot of neocons supported Kosovo. Yes, they did.
Okay, this is true. All
Weekly
right.
Standard
but not
all over that.
Okay, you're off the hook, Benny.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, I've written. I said, you know, I don't think. I thought Kosovo was great. We were going to get to that actually.
Right.
So
this is the hypocrisy point. But you're absolutely right that even if it's completely hypocritical, that's not really related to the merits.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
So where are you? You wrote a column that I read in preparation for this, saying it's not a matter of whether or not we withdraw, it's a matter of whether we do it quickly or do it slowly.
Did I say that?
I think so.
What did I say?
I think it was from October or November.
I'm sure you're
November.
Right. I think that what I was trying to say is that I think that we need to accept at this point that so far, the evidence seems to be that our occupation of Iraq is basically doomed, that we're doing more harm than good, and that given that, we need to figure out how to get out. And we can argue, and there are a lot of very important arguments about just how to do that. You know, do we get out fast? Do we get out slow? Do we get out a little bit and then a little bit more and then a little bit more?
Right.
Do we get out 80% but leave 20% for the indefinite future?
Sure.
You know, I actually don't know. I don't know the answer to those questions, but it does seem to me quite clear at this point, and nothing post-surge has happened to change this view, that it's not working. What we're doing is not working. You know, things are not getting better. If anything, they're getting worse.
You think that they're getting worse now?
It seems that way, yeah. They certainly don't seem to be getting better. And you know, I'm actually, you know, I'm not inherently anti-interventionist. You know, I think that there are situations which justify the use of U.S. military force in a sovereign state. You know, I think that preventing a genocide is one of those situations. If I believed that not only that ethnic cleansing genocide was about to escalate dramatically in Iraq, but part two, and this part two is as important as part one, but that we had the capacity to prevent it, then I would believe that we not only had a right to stay, but a duty to stay. But I am not convinced. It's possible that the first will happen, but I am not at all convinced that we have the capacity to do anything about it. Doesn't mean nobody has the capacity to prevent it, you know, but I think that U.S. military force, U.S. military combat troops, the numbers in which they are now there, I don't think that they have the capacity to prevent it. You know, I also think that the opinions of the local population, while they are not the end of the story, matter tremendously. It seems pretty clear that most Iraqis would like us to get out and actually think things would improve. You know, it's hard for me to – it's just really, really hard for me to see any alternative other than getting out. And by the way, I didn't start out this way. I mean, I started out – you know, I was very, very skeptical of the justification for – the Iraq War, but even notwithstanding the absence of WMD, et cetera, you know, I was in Iraq in August of 2003, and, you know, it was very moving how many Iraqis you met who said, thank God Saddam Hussein is gone, you know, and what a tyrant, and we're optimistic. And I thought that there was a biting chance that the war in Iraq could turn out to be a good thing for Iraq and for the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really thought that that was possible. And I think we just blew it, and it's devastating and it's tragic, and it's been devastating to the Iraqis. It's been devastating to the United States, to our broader national security interests. And so I don't like this, you know.
Yeah, no, I know. And so what would it take? Well, mm-hmm. What would it take to change your mind?
I think that if there was a significant mm-hmm. and durable improvement in security. You know, that would change my mind.
Okay. That's,
you know, and my view about the surge was I think it's a bad idea. I think it's too little, too late.
Well, why? Okay.
But you know, if through some miracle it works, then hooray.
Okay.
You know, then we change our views and we say, who would have thought it? But it worked. Thank God.
Okay. Well, look, first of all, I'm not quite willing to say it's working yet. But let me give you my case for cautious optimism.
And you're going next week, right?
Yeah, I am.
Have you been there?
Yeah, I was there in 2004.
Uh-huh. So not for a couple of years.
Yeah, right? Uh-huh. And before the war, I was right. in Tehran for 2 weeks, right. Observing.
Aha, uh-huh. What were you?
From uh-huh. there, which okay. But let me give you my my case for cautious optimism.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I really feel that. The one thing that all the Democrats, I mean, I don't think you can have the political solution, which I think everybody wants, mm-hmm. unless you do something to protect the neighborhoods that are not yet entirely cleansed in Baghdad.
Right.
So for me, it's heartbreaking. I wish there were more troops we could have sent to the surge, mm-hmm. but we needed to garrison those neighborhoods. And it seemed to, General Casey, for some reason, did not hold the areas he cleared, to use the terminology. The Bush administration in Washington had this idea that
right.
we were the cause of a lot of the resentment and we needed to reduce our size of our footprint, when what we needed to do was to stop, just genocidaires working on behalf of, or at least tolerated by, the Shiite majority government that did not share the same objectives that we did. And incidentally, I and a lot of other people sort of saw this coming. I mean, I did not write jubilantly after the November 05 elections or the December 05 elections. I said, you know, the confessional fundamentalist parties won. Anybody running as a kind of, you know, not on that kind of ticket was trounced.
Right.
And so, you know, we should have sort of seen this coming. And the tragedy in some ways was that in every case these developments happen, and the administration was very slow to react. And in some way, Ambassador Khalilzad's gamble that Muqtada al-Sadr, if brought into the political process, would moderate, was proven incredibly wrong. I mean, Sadr, you turned the ministries under the Mahdi army's control people would be rushed to hospitals under the Sadr-controlled health ministry, and they would then be, you know, killed if they weren't dead already. And this, to me, was just an impossibly awful state of affairs.
Right.
Clearly, you know, a sign of our failure. I mean, I had no problem in sort of admitting that, and that we needed to do something. And this strategy, in that it embedded our soldiers with Iraqi units and the presence, you know, I would say I'm cautiously optimistic because Sadr is allegedly now in Tehran, and he hasn't shown his face in Baghdad, and that because I think that he's a pernicious figure. Every week he's in Iran and not Iraq is degrading his nationalist credentials, and he certainly had a lot of them before. And the Mahdi army seems to have split. And for some reason, some people are saying that's not a good development. I think it's a wonderful development. If there's one segment of the Mahdi army that's willing to not, is willing to not be irredentist in asking for total Shiite domination of Iraq, and is willing to negotiate and play ball and not kill our American soldiers, I'll take it. That means we only, you know, that the federal Iraqi government and the Americans only have to kill half the Mahdi army. Maybe we can get all the Mahdi army to do that. But it's a good thing that in some ways they appear now to be decapitated. The other thing that I'm really cautiously optimistic about, based on my correspondence with the officers there, is that the Anbar Salvation Front.
American
officers, and I also talked to Iraqis. The Anbar Salvation Front, made up of these 42 sheikhs in Anbar, and led by this very brave guy who Al-Qaeda has tried to kill and successfully killed, many members of his family, this guy, Sheikh Abdul Sattar al-Rishawi, they seem to be, they've pledged their allegiance to, he's pledged his allegiance publicly to a Shia Prime Minister Maliki, which is a good thing, and he has agreed to cooperate and be part of the new counterterrorism task force, and they are devoted to grounding Al-Qaeda in Iraq into dust, which is a great thing, because Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in many ways, as I see it, is the chief cause of the potential for this competitive genocide in Iraq, in that they finally, managed to sort of turn the tide when they blew up the dome of the Golden Mosque in Samarra, and so there's no accommodation with them. We're not going to be able to negotiate anything with these lunatics, and so they have to delenda, they've got to go. So those are my causes for cautious optimism. There's still a lot of problems. There still is an intolerable amount of car bombing. There's still a lot of real peril. There's still too many IDP camps. There are too many people who have fled Iraq who are still not feeling it safe to return. So all of those factors I see as real problems. But to see that sort of tide has turned, and I think that, to see there's potential for this tide has turned, and at least if they can emulate this Anbar Salvation Front in Diyala and other provinces, then we could really defeat Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which would be a very good thing for Iraq and a good thing for us and a good thing for the region.
I hope you're right, but I suspect you're being overly optimistic.
Okay, well, fair enough. But I'm saying that these things have and Petraeus, I'm not just saying because Petraeus is talented. These are accomplishments from General Petraeus so far, and I just think that if you've got a strong group of Sunni Arabs in Iraq that are willing to fight Al-Qaeda, that's a good thing. I mean, we've had other tribal sheikhs before, but nobody was also willing to renounce the sort of sectarian fighting pledge that they're going to be, that they're going to be part of an Iraqi government and accept that there would be a Shiite majority. Now, I would change my mind and say there's really nothing we can do if one of the following, and I had to sort of think about this, the following sorts of things happened. One, if the Iraqi parliament said, leave, we don't want you here, I would have to support us leaving. Two, if it turned out that, indeed, the new political sort of developments like the Anbar Salvation Front were then bought off by Al-Qaeda, and that was combined with, more setbacks, then I would sort of say, at that point, we'd have to really think about sort of just accepting, and then I would favor something like moving the troops for the most part to Kurdistan. So that's the main thing. But I think if the parliament sort of succeeded in sort of saying, you've got to go, but I don't see Iraqis asking us necessarily to leave right now, and I think that that's some bad information. I think that they want us, I think a lot of Iraqis want us to protect them from these competitive genocidal forces.
I mean, it obviously it's very, very, very hard to get a handle on what the Iraqis want because, the government is hardly entirely representative at the moment. And also because, polling data, well, how accurate is it, frankly? I mean, so I'm basing this on the most recent polling data that there is. It could be wrong. I'm sure the Iraqis would like us to protect them, but equally it seems pretty clear that my sense from the data that we have, that a majority of them do not think that we can do so and think that at the moment we're making things worse. Here's something that I don't understand, though. I don't quite understand why the Bush administration is so terrified of the withdrawal date idea, other than just pride, because it seems to me
Congress, I mean, there's an easy answer to that.
But it seems to me that, surely everybody thinks that we don't want to stay there forever. It's expensive. Americans are getting killed, even aside from all of the other issues, right? And the date is a goal in the current formulation. What's wrong with saying having a date that is sufficiently far in the future to allow for possible change circumstances? If things start looking great, if everybody in Iraq starts saying, wow, boy, that surge thing sure turned things around, please, please stay longer, we love it, this is super, You know, hey, do we really think that Congress is going to say no?
Well, at this point, I really don't know. I mean, I think Congress or the leaders of Congress and the Democratic Party have really lost their minds. But I mean,
I don't think so. I don't think they've lost their minds at all. I mean, I think that there's an intense frustration both on their part and on the part of most Americans with the administration's sort of weird, just, you know, let's just throw more troops in with no obvious real difference other than that, with no fallback plan. You know, I think there's a lot of frustration. I think that they're acting on that. I do think, and here's something that I have been concerned by, that some of the rhetoric at times from some of the Democrats has been a little bit disturbingly, you know, we just wash our hands of this stuff. You know, just this is not our problem.
Well, I mean, I don't see how some Democrats I don't particularly care about, but
right.
I like Joe Biden. I want to like Joe Biden. You know, and he's said a lot of things in the past that I really agree with. I mean, I saw the Kosovo Democrats as fairly close to the neoconservatives. But, you know, for Biden to think that he's going to get his federalism plan in this environment, if we had not gone in there and had, you know, began to try to protect these neighborhoods, you think that people were going to reach political settlement? They were going to just say, great, okay, let's fight the war. And I think that that's very dangerous, because we both know that in these kind of confessional, ethnic, awful civil wars, that's not like the referendum of the people. Most people don't want to live under that circumstance. That is, you know, that's basically just empowering the most violent extremists on either side. And I think we have an obligation, because we did this, we're in there, to at least try to, if we want the political solution, to do what we can to, you know, demoralize, dissuade, or kill the extremists on both sides of that fight. And the other thing that I think that frustrates me is that, you know, Iraq's neighbors seem to have shown no real interest. I mean, maybe now they're coming around saying this could spread, it's a really bad thing, but let's not hold them harmless, particularly the Iranians, who have a tremendous amount of influence in Iraq. And whether or not we want to, you know, reopen this question about the EFPs, which I'm probably more convinced than you are, against American soldiers, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that they help recruit. They are the paymasters for militias that are going house to house, and that is awful. And that you know, and so.
I don't actually disagree with any of that.
Yeah.
But to me, it's much more a question of, you know, the U.S. has duties to the Iraqi people, no question about it. But those duties have to be discussed in the context of our capacities as well.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, and I think, I mean, I get very disturbed when some Democrats act as if we don't have any duty to the Iraqi people and, you know, just stop bothering us, go fight your own civil war, we don't care, leave us alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's totally wrongheaded and irresponsible. But I also get very disturbed when you get a rhetoric coming from neocons and from the right saying, oh, but we don't have an obligation to the Iraqi people, which is totally divorced from any realistic awareness of what we can do and what we can't do, you know, and you know, the first principle of, you know, humanitarian interventions of any sort, you know, is sort of do no harm. You know, if you can't do good, if you're only doing harm, then don't do it, because you're making things worse, you know. And of course, Iran and Syria and various other players are playing totally nefarious roles. It's hardly clear to me, however, that we know for sure that we could not get them to cooperate in helping to broker some kind of peace accord between the various factional parties. You know, you're an admirer of Madeleine Albright, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you know, that I think that the idea of trying to push some kind of Dayton-style conference, which is going to come up with some crummy result, which, however, would probably be better than the current catastrophic situation,
mm-hmm.
you know, which would require us to bring in the Iranians and the Syrians, various other people, not say we love you, you're so nice, but saying, you know, everybody has a stake in keeping this from getting completely out of control, which is what's going to happen.
I just think that some people have misread. I think that what the Iranians particularly want is for their, I don't think that they just want Shia dominance, okay? I mean, I think that I don't understand why Secretary Powell and Condoleezza Rice, I mean, for like 3 years, kept saying Iran has an interest in a stable Iraq. I don't think they do at all. They have an interest in a weakened Iraq.
Market. Yeah, they've well, but
and they, and
a weakened
and a perpetually
Iraq, but
fighting
stable,
Iraq,
Iraq
where they're the indispensable cop, the way that Syria was in Lebanon in the 1980s. They want, in the 1990s, they want a Taif Accords, where they're going to be the de facto masters of Iraq. And they're the only people who can, you know, keep peace. And that's why I've reported, and it's not surprising that they play multiple sides in the war because they're scumbags. And
well, speaking of which,
yes, okay,
this might be a good moment to segue into another thing we're going to talk about, which is the British sailors.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I do want to get to Madeline though.
Are you
well, I mean, okay, we can do Iranian. Yeah. Okay. We can, and then we can get into Madeline. The Iranian sailors. Yeah. They're just, you know, what is it with, maybe this is my question to you, okay? Why is it?
What is it with people with whom the U.S. is probably about to go to war that makes them long to no. bring that upon themselves and hasten that?
No, that was not my question. Oh, and by the way, we're not really going to, I mean, we're already kind of in a pseudo-war with them, but...
is that reassuring or...
Well, we're not, like, going to invade them. No one's going to... Who calls for invading Iran?
No, we don't have any troops.
Right, exactly. So no one's going to invade anybody. So what are we
talking
about?
We might bomb them.
Yeah, if we feel that they're, you know, very close to building a nuke, and they've ignored, like, however many UN Security Council resolutions, and it would be similar to, I don't know, Desert Fox,
Oh, you're an optimist, Eli.
Well, okay.
Touching,
I'm just saying... My question is, why is it that no matter what the Iranians do, there is a certain group of people who are guaranteed to say, we are really close to a deal if only we just spoke nicely to them. If only we offered them the correct tea and napkin service.
In the current situation, it's non-falsifiable. I mean, since we haven't tried, we'll never know.
Yes, we have tried. We've absolutely tried. Zalman Khalilzad has had numerous contacts with the Iranians. We brought in their opposition... Before the war, the Revolutionary Guard trained. We said, "Yeah, we're going to bring them in. They're part of the new government." We've done all kinds of things with them. I mean, it's always done the other way. Like, well, we had an opportunity; they helped us in Afghanistan. But nonetheless, they are a revolutionary, lunatic government that wants to just—they hate America. They hate the West. They see themselves very much. And furthermore, and this is a key point that I think a lot of the Iran doves missed and always miss, is that our interlocutors, when you were in the Clinton administration and then the beginning of the Bush administration, were Khatami's reformers. And a lot of Khatami's reformers, most of them, in fact, were purged deliberately. Maybe not because ostensibly they said because they were talking to us, but also because they were a threat to the clerical theocracy that most Iranians hated. And so instead of, you know, resolving it politically, the reform experiment didn't work. And it's not our fault. It's not because someone gave an Axis of Evil speech. It's because the scumbags that hold the real sort of violent pillars of the states decided to just purge them. Some of them they put on trial. Some of them they tortured in secret jails. And they were very close to Khatami. Those were our interlocutors, and we sort of lacked them. So the old argument, Iran's changing, there's both sides, you know, which node of power, blah, 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 blah. Now the people in charge are, you know, either the Rafsanjani lunatics or the, you know, IRGC lunatics, or the Ahmadinejad lunatics. So my question is, why is it that no matter what they do, there's always someone who will say, we're so close. I just spoke to Javad Zarif, he told me, you know?
I have no answer to that question.
Sorry.
I have no answer to that question. And I'm not going to dispute with you that the Iranian government is full of very unlovable people. And certainly I think that the business over the British sailors is an illustration of, you know, that people are not rational actors, among other things.
Yeah, they're pirates.
Well, it's I don't care if they're pirates or not, but you know, speaking rationally about it, right? If I were a state that was seriously threatened by a combination of UN sanctions, UN imposed sanctions, other regional sanctions, bilateral sanctions, and the very real possibility of a military strike by the US and or Israel, I would decide it was not really a good moment to go picking a completely unnecessary fight. You know?
Yeah.
It's stupid. Good point. Why would you do it?
Yeah.
Why would it doesn't make any sense, rationally speaking. speaking.
Yeah.
You know, unless concerns about muscle flexing and internal factional politics are trumping.
No, I think it's because they think they're winning. They think that, like, they just think they're weak.
I think that as you said, there are a lot of different thems.
So, yeah, fair enough.
Know, and that's part of the problem.
Right.
And, you know, part of the problem in CIA's sort of the first agency to say this is that we have very little idea what's going on behind the scenes.
True.
You know, who's got the upper hand, you know, who's really behind which pieces of this, who's pushing, who's pulling, who's saying calm down, slow down, who's saying, you know, I don't care if we all go up in flames, you know, then we'll have eternal glory for going up in flames, we're going to take them down with us. I mean, you know, we don't know what's going on. And that's very, very scary. To me, though, you know, the engage with Iran argument is not premised on either some notion that we'll go and sing kumbaya with them and they'll all
yeah.
learn to love us and they'll say, gee, never mind about that Islamic extremism stuff,
mm-hmm.
And never mind about nuclear weapons, you know, nor is it premised on the idea that, yes, they're nasty and loathsome, but we just have to accept that
yeah.
we have to deal with nasty, loathsome people, and that's the end of the story. I mean, I think that you can have engagement that is premised on, you know, they're nasty and loathsome in some ways, but they're not necessarily homogeneous. There may be some levers there, and one of the crucial ways to find out is you keep talking. You keep talking, you talk, and you talk, and you talk, you know, and it may never get you anywhere, but part of it, you know, the process is partly an end in itself because it gives
yeah.
you some insight into what the hell they're thinking. You know, who are the players, who contradicts whom, who sits, who stands, you know, and we're deprived.
Right.
I mean, to me...
You don't you think Javier Solana shares his notes?
I don't think it's a substitute.
We've also been fairly generous. We've even accepted, like, okay, you have a right to nuclear power.
Yeah, right.
We'll build it for you.
I mean, to me, this is just an intelligence issue. You know, that it has it really is independent of some specific outcome of direct engagement with Iran. It's just an intelligence tool. You know, you talk to your enemies so that you get a better sense of what they're thinking. I mean, that's one of the many baffling things about the Bush administration. This goes back to our conversation earlier about.
Yeah.
Guantanamo, et cetera, you know, that in a way they seem just determined to deprive themselves of the international support and the intelligence that they need.
Well, I think that there is a point where part of what the Bush administration, or at least the president wants to do, though certainly not everyone who works for him, is to begin to degrade their sovereignty and to say, and
is that kind of like degrading uranium?
I don't know. But one of the things that when this is a good segue into Secretary Albright, but when Madeleine Albright went to North Korea,
mm-hmm.
Wendy Sherman explained to all of us and that one of the parameters of the deal was please stop selling long range and medium range missile technology to bad people, and in exchange we will do things like, you know, through the Kyoto Accords and so forth, we'll give you fuel and we'll help this, you know, rickety regime stay in power, because that's the one thing that they have that we can help them. And in the process, you know, even if it worked, it would have been great if process we stopped them from getting a nuke, we stopped them from, you know, developing long-range missiles and selling it to other people. I mean, that would have been great. But part of the deal that always ends up happening is that in states, especially like in the Islamic Republic of Iran, one of the things that they would want from us is to sort of accept them and do things to help them survive as a regime. And I think that it's fair to say, at least I feel, that to sort of use an insight from the from Danny Postel, who just wrote a book on the Iranian opposition and the left in America, you know, there is a legitimation crisis, as Habermas said, in Iran right now. The Islamic Revolution...
You're good, Eli.
Well, they failed. They have failed. Okay, most Iranians want an open society. They want, you know, they want what we have.
Right.
And I don't want to help them at all. In fact, I want to push them over the cliff. With nonviolence, by the way, I'm not trained. I don't want to arm the PKK. I'm not about that. I don't want Iranian Contras. Not for me. This kind of gets me into this. I thought this is going to sound nuts, okay? Because there's a lot about what Madeleine Albright does that I don't like, okay? I didn't like her chasing after Arafat and so forth. But
do you like her brooches?
I liked her brooches with the UN. When she had the snake for Saddam. But you know, if we could figure out a Serbia solution for Iran, which is, don't put an American flag on it. I don't care where it comes from. Make the Costa Ricans in charge. But give the people who are in the democracy movement in Iran the kind of help and the way that they can accept it. And then just, you know, use your diplomacy in such a manner that will advantage them. If they say, now's not the time to enter into negotiations with the Iranians, then don't do it. But maybe they'll say, now's the time, really, you know, decrease the pressure, and it's good for us if you do that. Right. And over time, I think that that's a winner, because nobody wants, I mean, I was only in Iran for 2 weeks, but I didn't find anybody, people were openly flouting, teenagers were openly, they were smoking weed, you know, they were listening to rock and roll. It seemed like, you know, it seemed a little bit like New Jersey.
Right. Well, okay.
Yeah.
So one note of caution in the context of basically agreeing with you. The note of caution, and somewhere in there you said, you know, and then let's rely on them to tell us if this is a good time for negotiation, should we wait, et cetera.
Yeah, okay, fair. I see where
you're going. The problem is they are like New Jersey, and if you ask people in New Jersey on any given question, you'd get 6,000 different answers.
Right.
You know, that if you wanted to fund the Democratic opposition in New Jersey, God, somebody should live
like
New Jersey,
let's
right?
get smart
you know?
People who do this for a living.
That's just a note of caution that I think a mistake that we very frequently make, again, out of ignorance, is underestimating the complexity, overestimating the homogeneity of any group of people we're dealing with, and then we'll have some articulate and plausible-seeming person or group will come to us and say, well, here's the way it really is, and we'll go, aha, you know, and rely on them to the exclusion of other sources and end up getting screwed.
But, you know, Jim O'Brien, who I think is really one of these underrated guys. Who,
I like Jim O'Brien.
He's a great guy.
Tremendously impressive.
But he studied like the contours of the Serbian opposition,
right?
And he figured out that Otpor was really where it was at, and these old guys that we've been supporting for like 6 years, they were never going to win anything. So there was a kind of that you can. I mean, if someone really, if intelligent people who are familiar with like Gene Sharp and the history of sort of nonviolent struggle and theory, people like Peter Ackerman, if people like that who are really good at this look at the situation and are not influenced by, like, the MEK or other Iranian groups.
Well, I basically agree with the general idea that in whenever you have a repressive state, that if your long-term goal, you know, is not just keeping that repressive state from doing, you know, some particular aggressive thing, but your long-term goal is also, you know, fostering a transition to a more democratic state, that you need to try to give support to people who are standing up for basic democratic norms and human rights and so forth. Doing that is tricky. You know, doing that itself requires a lot of cultural know-how that we often don't have. But I think it's a good thing. And I
use Iranian Americans.
Sure, absolutely. I also think that one of the many casualties of the last 6 years of the Bush administration has been democracy promotion and the promotion of human rights as central aspects of U.S. foreign policy. You know, that the Bush administration rhetorically embraced those. And I think it was actually not just rhetorical.
No, it wasn't.
You know, I think that they really believed in it.
Yeah.
But they did it in such a stupid way that it backfired. It appeared to many people both outside of the U.S. and inside the U.S. as just a sort of naked instrument of U.S. imperialistic agenda, advancing U.S. imperialistic agenda of some sort.
Yes.
You know, and it also was just done so
the NED
so
guys
stupidly.
Run, yeah.
You know, it was done in the kind of most dim-witted way with the least amount of interest in actually understanding things like that the groups you're dealing with are not homogeneous, that there are lots of different dissenters, that some of them have greater credibility than others, that they're working for different things, that they have their own agendas, you know, and that's a tragedy. It's a tragedy because, you know, it seems to me, I mean, from the perspective of you know, as a Democrat, as a progressive, it seems to me that, you know, if the U.S. can play no other role in the world than being a nation that peacefully promotes democracy and human rights, you know, that's what we should be doing. You know, what's the point if we can't do that
stuff? Thank you. Well, that's what I'm saying.
And one of the things that's so tragic is that I think that in a funny way, you know, now, for generations, in some sense, you know, liberals kind of owned those issues. And I think that
Reagan was pretty good at that.
They've been so discredited by this administration that it's actually going to be tough to convince a lot of people. Ooh, there's a. I'm looking. By the way, I have to just stop. There's a pigeon right outside my window, who is like sitting there staring at me and kind of pecking at the window. You want something? What do you want? You want to go to Iran? God, it's flying away. Okay. That was very fascinating. I had a visitation from the animal kingdom. But anyway, I foresee a problem for a Democratic president, if a Democratic president should come in the next election, in trying to sell to Congress and the American people the idea that promoting democracy and human rights ought to be part of our foreign policy because it's been so badly discredited. And I think that's a shame. I think that Democrats need to, I think the Democrats desperately need to do the hard work now, even though it may seem sort of unsexy and, you know, a sort of longer term problem, of trying to articulate basic principles for a, you know, what is it, what is a progressive democracy promotion and human rights promotion policy going to look like? Because it's really important, and I would hate to see that go.
Can I tell you what the problem is?
Yes.
It's the same problem that plagued the Republicans. It's this realist, Scowcroftian, offshore balancing riffraff that you've let into the party, and you're going to regret it. You're going to regret it. Maybe not now.
You know, I'm a realist. I don't think these shouldn't be mutually exclusive.
No,
right?
Realists don't care. They think, what does it matter if Tehran is a democracy?
That's right, but the realists should care, because it does matter.
But they wouldn't be realists if they cared.
Well, then the realist is the wrong term for them.
All right, fine.
Then they're lying about what they really are. Then they're unrealists.
Well, I don't mean that, like, they're realistic.
Yeah,
I meant it, like,
in
the foreign policy school. I'm just saying that, you know, you've opened your arms to all these disgruntled Bush 1 types because they say bad things about the neoconservatives, and it gets you guys going.
Yeah. No, that's right.
But you know what I know, that sooner or later, there's going to be a huge clash. And I'm going to be on your side when you clash because I don't like those people.
And you'll be welcome, Eli. I
grew up very left-wing.
Okay, so tell me about your childhood, Eli.
You really want to know? I thought we were going to talk about Hillary Clinton.
I do. No, I want to. My
parents belonged to food co-ops.
Uh-huh.
Babysitting co-ops.
Did you have to eat stuff like carob brownies and soy?
Yeah,
milk?
A bit of that.
Oh, man.
I went to the secular Jewish children's folk shul, which was a secular humanist take on Judaism.
So did you have to, like, sing secular humanist songs or something?
There was a lot of that. We learned about how the struggle of the Israelites, similar to the struggle of the self-determination in Nicaragua. My first rally was for Geraldine Ferraro.
Oh, Eli, there's still hope for you then.
Well, I don't know. No, actually, no. Okay, because I... Anyway, but it's more of a...
You want to talk about Hillary Clinton.
I want to talk about Hillary because...
Speaking of people who drive people into the arms of the neoconservatives.
Okay, first of all, isn't it my side of the aisle's job to just demonize this woman? Why... When did this become the preoccupation of, like, the American prospect bloggers? All those young Turks. You know what I'm saying?
Is that what they're preoccupied with? I've always wondered what they're...
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, are they getting notes from, like, David Horowitz or something? Like, what's going on with this?
Right. I don't know. I think that Hillary, circling back to the very first discussion we had before we had technical problems, which hopefully people will be able to hear, we were talking about the Swift boat veterans, in the Kerry campaign, and why progressives and Democrats get so angry at the Swift voters, and I was saying that I think that partly because liberals rightly felt that the claims and charges by the Swift voters were irresponsible and unfair and hypocritical, but it's also in equal parts because liberals were very upset at the Kerry campaign, Kerry for disowning his own past, for not saying very honestly, look, here's what I said, here's what I still agree with, here's what I regret, now let's move on.
Right.
And I think that people have the same, that's the same reason people don't like Hillary. You know, that a lot of people, a lot of progressives see her as somebody who won't own herself, won't own her own views. You know, and they worry about that both in terms of winning over Democrats and in terms of winning over
Democrats. So she's not really like the most muscular Zionist in the world? Are you telling me the truth?
Gotta hope not.
You're crushing me here.
Sorry. Nobody knows. I mean, I think that they're, you know, I think Hillary Clinton is obviously smart. You know, she's obviously very capable.
Right.
I don't doubt at all that there is an inner Hillary that is a good person and a compassionate person and a smart person and, you know, a dedicated person. But I it's very, very hard to see that Hillary, you know, and that makes people very, very uneasy, I think. It makes them uneasy both because it becomes hard to really know what she thinks and what she's going to do, And it makes them uneasy precisely because I think people do fear some kind of repeat of the Kerry stuff, where you lose not because you once said something that outraged some people, but you lose because you start trying to deny it or change the subject rather than saying, look, here's what I said, here's what I meant, and I still think that, and here's why, or, and I shouldn't have said it, that was a stupid thing to say, sorry, you know, one or the other, but just, you know, be who you are, and if you change your mind, tell us why, but don't just, you know, I mean, I think that's what people find so tough about her. It's what I find a little tough about her. You know, I would love to support, you know, a great woman, great liberal woman candidate for president, and I just have a really, you know, if she is the candidate, I will support her, but I have a tough time. Because Obama's the Messiah, that's the other thing. So,
okay, you know. I saw that, the last dialogue, by the way.
Because
according to Garant's Frankie Ruta, the reason why Hillary's facing such a tough time is because women really support her, but men are freaked out, basically. I mean, I'm summarizing. I'm not even doing a really good job summarizing.
Yeah.
But I have to say that when I covered, I wrote about her in her first campaign for The Forward, the Jewish newspaper, and I wrote this story about how she was fundraising with the in the home of, like, Hani al-Masri, who was a big funder of Arafat, and it was a good New York story. But then I sort of, after I wrote that and then seeing her progress, she's been to the right of Bush on the Israel-Palestine issue. I mean, she calls the suicide bombing industry, she accuses them of being child abuse. She says, you know, just calls it child abuse, which is, and she's just very morally clear on this stuff. And maybe it's overcompensation for Suha, but she said it enough that I started thinking, and she was always, like, really tough on the war. And Michael Crowley in the New Republic, in this issue, has a piece on how she's actually really a hawk deep down. And I would not have voted for her because she's also a socialist. But
she's not. If only, come on. I mean, well,
right.
I mean, who the hell knows?
But I thought she would have been all right on the war.
I forgot what I was going to say. Yeah, anyway, go on.
No, what I'm saying is that she did it enough. And she is a smart, competent politician.
Okay, I remember what I was
saying. Okay,
say
it. I'm sorry.
You know, she's doing a classic thing that Democrats do that I think does not work, which is she is overcompensating for the fear that people see Democrats as quote unquote softer on national security by doing a whole lot of chest thumping. You know, and it's fake. And I think it's stupid too, because I think, you know, what Democrats ought to be doing is articulating why this is about, you know, being smart instead of being stupid, smart power versus stupid exercise of power, you know, and breaking away from these soft, hard, you know, tough, wimpy frames. And she plays right into them. And I think, you know, it's the don't think about, what is the, I'm going to get this, I'm going to mangle this, right? You know, don't think about a white elephant, right? And then you can't help thinking about it. And whenever you see Hillary Clinton saying, I'm so tough, I am just so tough, all you can think of is, you know,
well, not anymore. She said she's going to end the war.
Right. Well, yeah.
I thought when Code Pink started protesting her and stuff, that it was really good for her. And I thought, actually, if I was Barack Obama, I would call up their people and figure out a way to get Code Pink to protest him. I mean, because I think that the further the Democrats can cleave themselves from sort of the extreme of the anti-war movement, that is very much in the kind of ACT-UP activism style.
But here's, I mean, aside from just generically being the Messiah, which I do need to keep reminding people of, Obama, you know, Obama has the virtue of having been consistent and having made sense from the beginning, you know, being very clear, saying, you know, I'm not anti-war. You know, there are times when wars are justified. This isn't one of those times, you know, and here's why. And just laying it out in a very straightforward way, you know, and being perfectly willing, saying, you know, and here are the things that would have changed my mind, you know, but this didn't happen, and here's why, you know, here's why I feel the way I do.
Yeah.
And Hillary, you know, it just, her credibility is low. And I don't know. I haven't read Garance's article.
You should, it's a good one.
I haven't followed.
But then she gets, she's everybody, but everybody's disagreeing with her, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, it certainly is not. My instinct is that, you know, Hillary is not, in the end, going to necessarily be the biggest draw for women voters.
It's going to be the Messiah.
But,
Obama.
Yeah, it's going to be the Messiah.
How close is he still? he's still really close with Samantha Power.
As far as I know, but I'm not in the inner circle.
I can't imagine Samantha Power, and I saw her write this when she said she's trying to come up with the position. But I think if you're Samantha Power, if you're part of that school, you just can't abandon Baghdad right now.
Oh, I don't think but I think that's unfair to Samantha's argument. I don't think I think she's making a variant of the same argument I was making a little while ago. It's not about abandoning Baghdad.
Capability.
No, it's about distinguishing between, you ought to do in a perfect world and what you can do.
Right.
And recognizing when your capacity just isn't there, coming up with a backup plan.
Okay.
I think it's consistent. You know what? I actually am going to have to go because I have two little children waiting at home and I have to get out of here and get on a train and go and give them dinner and put them to bed and stuff like that.
Okay, and I've got to file a story.
Okay, and you've got to go to
Baghdad.
And I've got
to go to Baghdad.
Yeah.
So,
well, be safe, Eli.
It was really, this was good doing it with you.
It was a lot of fun.
A lot of fun.
And be very careful. Keep your head down.
Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.